Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds.
It's Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Gene DiNardo. Bill G sitting in for Jake Cowan this week as a special guest co-host. It is Thursday, September 6, 2012, and here are the headlines we'll be looking at today. Gene's going to be fact-checking on Bill Clinton's speech at the Democratic National Convention, and we'll also take a look at Elizabeth Warren's comment that she has made in the past, no, Governor Romney, corporations are not people. We're going to take another look at LIBOR because that's an ongoing investigation and ongoing issue, and we will take a particular look at it from two viewpoints, one from Bloomberg and one from Politico. Bill's been doing some more research into mark-to-market, and he's got an interesting story about how the shadow housing inventory is being hidden by that. And we're going to start off the hour with news coming from the European Central Bank that they are willing to engage in unlimited buying of bonds. This is the euro basically, or the ECB to the rescue of the euro. It's controversial among the various investors out there, and of course we're going to basically tear it to shreds because it's really just another step in the wrong direction. But Gene's got some more details. Gene, what did you find out?
Well, the Euro Bank came out with a statement. I believe it's Mario Draghi came out and basically said that they're going to feed money into the system by buying bonds. They said they were going to concentrate. You might have some better specifics, but as far as I could find, they weren't very specific, but they did say they were going to buy the bonds of the countries in Europe that aren't doing so well, such as Spain, Italy, etc., and in order to try and push down their cost of borrowing. And of course, you know, behind this is if they buy the bonds up, the people will be more willing to pay for these bonds. As the supply and demand, as the demand for them won't increase, but the supply will have gone down because the central bank will now own very many of these bonds. They didn't say how they're going to pay for it. They didn't say whether they actually were going to pay for it or whether they were going to print money, as far as I could find. One thing they did say, they're not going to touch interest rates. They're hoping the interest rates on these bonds of these countries will be lowered, of course, and make their debt more affordable. What will happen, we'll just have to see, but apparently they're following the footsteps of Ben Bernanke and the U.S. Central Bank and using the same type of method where you just buy it all up and just kind of twist the economy that way. We'll see if it'll help. It's a big question.
It is a big question. And, of course, anyone who's a listener to this show knows what the answer is. We do sound like a broken record at times.
Yeah, we do. We need a new record. Tell me, did you hear that they said they were going to actually create the money, or they were going to use money they already had, or did they say that? I know the European Bank is a little bit more conservative in that aspect. At least that's what I've read, but I didn't see anything saying one way or the other.
Well, they've said all along they're not going to print any new money when they do this, and that's been the standard line from day one. But honestly, the way they do it is they basically put it on their balance sheet, and when they put it on the central bank's balance sheet, well, you've basically created money.
Right.
You know, it all depends on whether or not you believe
it's also
that
not something they advertise either.
Yeah. So, you know, Bill, what's your take on this? Are they creating money?
It's pretty obvious they're creating money here. Where else are they going to get the money? The Germans already said that they don't want to put the bill anymore. So the European Central Bank comes out and says, we're going to buy bonds. Well, how did the Fed do it? They did it by printing money. So they may not be running printing presses. Maybe that's what they mean. They're being coy with their wording here, but they are definitely printing money.
Now, Ben Bernanke has convinced everybody that the Fed didn't print money either. I mean,
yeah.
That's that line along very effectively.
Yeah, or not very much. You know, the interesting effect, I think, will be on the worldwide market. And Jake was a big one on this, on how, you know, our inflation is exported. But now you have, you know, the Europeans really pushing this same vein of action that the Central Bank of the United States does. So it's kind of, you know, what will happen to prices? You know, will the prices in the United States be affected? You know, obviously they probably will be affected in Europe, and I don't think they need any of that because Europe's already way more expensive than it should be. So at least for the people who live there. So.
Well, the equity markets definitely rejoiced at that announcement. The Dow was up over 240 points today, the last time I checked.
Wow.
244, I believe, is where it closed. So you're right. It was definitely, they were dancing in Wall Street today. Not in the street, but in Wall Street. And in fact, Gene, you were asking about some of the details. I have a couple sources on that. First of all, coming from Reuters, there are some limitations on this, and the limitations are surprisingly close to what Draghi has said in the past. They're saying that there are going to be unlimited amounts of bonds purchased. These will be 3-year maturity of countries that request a European bailout and fulfill strict policy conditions. And that's one of the catches. The countries have to request the bailout, and the very first country on everybody's radar is Spain, because Spain is the one that is imminently in the most difficulty. And in fact, there's some speculation, I'm not sure how accurate it is, but there is some speculation that Spain might not be willing to pull the trigger on that one, because they have to sign all this paperwork. Basically, they call it a memorandum of understanding, and this from MarketWatch. It involves a significant loss of sovereignty and potentially extra fiscal austerity, and means that the other Eurozone governments will have to agree to such support. That's an interesting stipulation right there. I mean, if the ECB is saying they're going to do this, well, I thought the ECB had the authority to do that. Apparently not. Apparently they have to get the support of the other countries, and of course the big problem all along has been Germany. Germany's been unwilling to back the idea of bond buyouts. So it raises a couple of questions here. First, is this just Draghi trying to push the boundaries, so to speak, and basically corner the Germans, or does this actually represent a real significant change in policy? I kind of suspect a little bit of both. What do you think, Bill?
I would agree with you that I think they are trying to pressure the Germans.
Yeah, Go ahead. I think they're really feeling the squeeze. I mean, these countries are in bad shape, and even if Germany takes the hard line, and you know, other countries kind of follow in kind of an order, but you know, they know that if any of these countries go under, it's a significant impact on all the countries, including Germany, even with their strong standing. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting.
And more from the MarketWatch article, the ECB has made it clear that it seeks only to address the rising yields that reflects what it believes are unfounded fears of Eurozone breakup, and not that which reflects irresponsible fiscal policy. Well, of course not. Of course,
which is pretty ridiculous, because the investors are all, your institutional investors are already bracing for a Euro breakup.
Right.
They're taking out unprecedented amounts of credit default swaps. They are they're liquidating their foreign corporate holdings, and they're dumping all of their foreign sovereign debt, their European sovereign debt. So and the stuff they can't get rid of, they're getting swaps on. So the markets are already preparing for this.
Hmm. There is another point that the MarketWatch article raises, and Bill, I was hoping maybe you could elucidate on it, because I have to admit it confused me a little bit. It said that the ECB bank, will sterilize all of its purchases by taking deposits from commercial banks, just as it did under the SMP. Now, what exactly are they saying there? Are they talking about basically taking more, holding more reserves for commercial banks, or are they talking about something else?
I don't know. That's got me a little confused too. It sounds to me like they are going to be using the money from depositors as the basis for doing these purchases, and which is kind of funny considering that a lot of the banks in Europe are experiencing a bank run right now. So where's the money coming from?
Yeah, and that's the thought that was going through my mind. Not only is there a bank run going on right now, but essentially there is a tremendous amount of ill will by European population as a whole toward their European neighbors. I can't imagine what the attitude is going to be when they finally realize that their own deposits are going to be underwriting all of this new monetary creation, which isn't really monetary creation, apparently.
It is. Yeah, well, yeah, obviously it is monetary creation. There's no, because the deposit money is still available on demand by those, by the depositors. So where is it coming from?
And I have to raise a question here. The big thing that Ben Bernanke did, and I mentioned it earlier, the big swindle that he pulled on the world, and that the world apparently swallowed hook, line, and sinker, is that when the Fed engaged in its own bond buying, it wasn't actually creating money. Now, you and I know that they really were, but the financial markets seem to have bought that one. They seem to have bought the Keynesian line, so to speak. And this seems to be a continuation of it. I mean, if you needed to have anything that would more closely resemble what would be true monetary creation, wouldn't it be using depositor money to basically multiply the amount of money available just through the multiplier effect? I mean, that's about as close as you're ever going to get to the traditional monetary creation system.
Yeah, since it's already been used for something else anyway. So they're using it three times.
But the markets would say, hey, wait a minute, that's what gets us in trouble. Hold on a second.
They're clutching at straws. The markets are clutching at straws here. They're looking at anything for to give them even a ray of hope. And then my guess is that maybe by the end of this week or early next week, we'll be looking at a market correction that'll get rid of all these gains that we got today.
And yet,
and probably then some.
I can't imagine that the vast majority of traders, large scale traders on Wall Street, are fools when it comes to this kind of thing. So it raises.
No, they're not fools. What they're doing is they're artificially inflating the price to create a rally, and then the institutional investors then sell at a high rate, which then sparks another panic, and then it's your individual investors who end up losing most of their money.
So you're thinking that this is actually a setup for a crash?
Yeah, probably.
Well, that's certainly auspicious leading into the November elections.
Yeah.
I don't see. I mean, I don't really see a. I mean, I could see corrections, like you said, Bill, but I don't really see a significant crash.
No,
unless,
neither do I.
Unless one of the countries does default, or two or three countries, and then I see, you know, just a radical reaction by the markets, because, you know, this is everything they believe in. You know, I think they truly are. I think most of the investors, the big-time investors in the market, they believe in the system. I mean, you know, it's their bread and butter. And, you know, they probably don't look as – most of them probably don't look as deeply into it as somebody who's really critical of it. But, yeah, I think, you know, any country going under, you know, a couple countries in Europe or even a breakup, and there could be just an incredible correction or crash, if you will, I guess.
Well, it's kind of like the medieval church when the plague first came out. It's they're holding on to orthodoxy as much as they possibly can because it served them so well in the past.
Right.
And
that's
then as things start to crash around them, they still hold on to that orthodoxy for as long as they possibly can, even when it kills them.
That's a great analogy, and that's true. You know, the markets are in. You know, they're in with the entire system, and. You know, they believe in it, they support it, basically because it's their bread and butter. You know, it pays the bills. Morton pays the bills.
Yeah, and you know, and I see this with institutional investors, and I even see this with individual investors. They are blindly optimistic about the markets, and because it served them well in the past. They say, well, there's always going to be a bounce back. You know, they point to 2007, and they look at the Dow Jones as it is now, and they're like, hey, look, we're right back where we were, so this must be a recovery. And without really looking really much beyond that.
Right. I agree.
Well, all I can think is that this must be a case of Hegelian dialectic, which I've always thought was a bunch of crap. But I mean, but seriously, I mean, the whole concept of a dialectic is basically, now this is my rather sarcastic way of putting it, but it's basically taking two incompatible ideas, holding them together in your mind at the same time and saying that they go together.
Exactly.
That's basically what dialectic
exactly.
thinking is.
Exactly.
That seems to be what's going on here. They know, they understand that the system is falling apart. They all agree that the system's in crisis. And yet they've convinced themselves that somehow this is going to fix everything. I mean, they know it doesn't work, but nevertheless, this is going to work.
But, yeah. You know, huh? on the other hand, if the money is going into their accounts, in other words, if they're profiting, they'll tend to, you know, people tend to believe in something that's real like that. I mean, of course, the average person is not happening to them, so they take a more negative or realistic view. But, you know, if you're a big-time investor and, you know, you still made $8 million last year, you know, what are you complaining about? You know, sure, you believe in the system.
Yeah.
And the thing that I don't see is what stops the market during a decline from becoming a crash, because now we're basically saying that the buyers are institutional investors and large investors trying to bid the market up so that they can cash out at the top. Okay, once they're out of the market, who's left to buy?
Mm-hmm.
Because
well,
there's
nobody
left to buy.
Your individual investors who are left over.
How's the price stabilize if there's nobody left to buy?
Yeah.
I think, you know, one way to look at it, I think, is when the price gets to a certain point, people stop selling.
Well, the institutional investors are unlikely to jump out of the market, because even in the event of a crash, they now put these fail-safes in there, these trade holidays, or in the markets themselves. Say the Dow drops down 400 points, trading stops at that point to allow cooler heads to prevail. And the institutional investors see that as a buying opportunity at that point, because now things are stopped. And so then things will go right back up again, even if the markets in reality are crashing.
That's interesting. And a lot of this...
We have a sort of prolonged crashes. We don't have the instant crashes anymore.
Like the flash crash can never happen again because they put all those fail-safes in.
What we have are prolonged train wrecks that last weeks at a time.
Yeah, exactly.
Or years.
But during those train wrecks, things go up and down because your institutional investors are still profit-taking throughout the process.
Well, you know,
so answer the question, who's doing the buying? Somebody's got to buy even for a little bit.
True.
Well, it's computers that are doing the buying.
Well, yeah, they are programmed. I mean, the computers are programmed to buy at a certain point. So
yes, exactly. So those who are buying, it's algorithms that are doing the buying. It's not individual rational human beings that are doing the buying. It's the algorithms that are maximizing their portfolio returns by timing the market exactly the way it is, and they do this in nanoseconds. They don't do this in anything longer than that.
Well, maybe the investment banks better recheck the credit ratings of these computers.
Yeah.
I mean, we laugh now, but oh my goodness! I mean, the more I think about this, the more it just says to me disaster. Because
there's a great book that I just read, called the Fear Index by Robert Harris. And it's a fictionalized account of the flash crash, and you learn a lot from that. I learned a lot from that book.
Well, I'm learning to stay as far away from the market as possible. That's what I'm learning.
Well, that's good. I think that's good advice. I've actually always followed that. You know, what is it? What do you get out of it? It's like, you know, you got all this money that's hard earned. You know, you're out there working. You're going to invest it. So where do you invest it? Well, let me buy a stock. What do you get? You get this piece of paper. You know, you don't even get
a piece of paper anymore.
Well, yeah, you don't even get a piece of paper. Apparently, you own this company that you have absolutely no say in what they do. You've given somebody your money, and you have no control over it. I don't see any great advantage in that, other than if you happen to make money at it. I mean, that's the plus right there.
Yeah, well, investment isn't done for the sake of the company's sake, who you're buying stock for anymore, or buying a bond for. It's all about gaming the system.
Gaming the system, right.
Which is absolutely sickening. Well, now that I'm ready to throw up, let's move on to another subject that will cheer us up immensely, and that is that Bill's been doing some research into mark-to-market. Bill's been giving us some great insights from the investment banker's perspective as well as the economist's perspective on how mark-to-market actually works in the real-time marketplace. And you've dug up some interesting information about the housing inventory, the unsold housing, and how it's affecting not only the real estate market but the overall market as well. What did you find?
Well, it all started out when I was thinking about in the financial crisis in 2009. I lost my house I lived in Burlington, New Jersey, and I had to do a deed in lieu, which is basically you hand the deed over to the bank and they stop the foreclosure process. But on your credit report, it still comes out as a foreclosure. Hmm. Well, the house has been sitting vacant now since 2009, and there's no sign outside. It's starting to fall apart, and I was wondering to myself, well, how is this representing a housing recovery? Mm. You know, this empty house sitting on a corner lot in Burlington City. How is this representing recovery? Because they're all talking about a housing recovery. So I pulled up this article by Nick Tamer. Tammy Rose from the Wall Street Journal blog, and yeah. It was saying that the number of bank-owned properties as of May is just over 407,000, and it peaked in 2008 for 700,000. And is this in, yeah, 407,000 at the end of May. And so I was like, well, okay. Well, how are they marking these things? How is this stuff showing up on their balance sheets? And how is this? What is the real value here? Well, first of all, I don't think my house even counts on their balance sheet because I went and checked with the township's the municipal building to see who's the deed holder of record, and I'm still the deed holder of record. I mean, I haven't had this house has been technically bank owned since 2009, and but according to official records and tax records, it still belongs to me.
Well, that's interesting.
So
that's pretty wild.
So this piece of the what they call the shadow inventory doesn't even exist on anyone's balance sheet.
So do you think the records just haven't been updated or
I think Citibank, who's the mortgage holder, is intentionally leaving it in my name, you know, putting it as a foreclosure in process rather than a foreclosed home.
Oh,
so that
right.
way it doesn't end up on the foreclosed inventory list.
Hmm.
So isn't there in the foreclosure process a time limit that things have to happen, or can they just extend on indefinitely?
The rules right now is they can extend indefinitely.
Really?
Well, foreclosure in process, couldn't you go back and live in it?
I could. I've entertained the thought. I could probably go back. I could have been squatting this whole time instead of living in my parents'.
You could be an occupier. Huh.
I mean,
they did come in and change
though.
The box.
Well, you know, that's the whole thing. There, it's hard to know what to believe. You know, when you have an institution, a banking institution can basically, account the way they wish. So we really don't know what is out there as far as the housing. You know, I still notice quite a few empty homes. You know, there's
oh yeah,
left.
You go through any neighborhood and you see empty homes all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
No signs out front, no for sale signs, no bank-owned foreclosure sales going on, but the houses are clearly abandoned.
Well, this raises a question regarding the market rules, because
yeah.
if this housing falls outside of what is required for mark-to-market, then what is this, real estate that doesn't exist?
Yeah, it's more than shadows. It's more like in the dark.
So by leaving it not in your name but in the process, like you said, how does that benefit as far as from an accounting standpoint?
Well, from an accounting standpoint, that allows the bank to evaluate the property based on what is owed on the the mortgage rather than what the current market value is.
Rather than current market value, right.
Were you able to find any numbers at all that suggest just how large this shadow housing inventory is? And I asked this question knowing full well that if they don't have any record of your house, they're not going to have any record of the other houses. But I figure there are, must be people out there trying to figure out what this amounts to.
Well, I have an idea. I went and checked the FAS 157, which is the mark-to-market disclosure for Citigroup, and I found that they have over $600 billion in loan assets that are listed under the Level 3 portfolio, which is their unobservable inputs for their thing. In the disclosure, they said that these inputs are based on their own models.
Unobservable inputs? What's the definition, or do they even define
Observable it? Input is these assets are not available. They're available for sale, but you can't. You have to take a broker dealer's word for it that they are what they are, what they say they are, or you have to rely on their modeling in order to rely on the number.
Well, where does the broker dealer come into this?
Well, not necessarily on this one, but this is in this particular instance. You've got they've got $600 billion in these level three loans, what they're calling just general loans, which are your mortgages, and they are evaluating based on their own models. So this is all of their shadow inventory. That's my suspicion, that this is their shadow inventory that they're declaring on their statements, that they are evaluating at the loan value rather than the market value, so they're artificially inflating it, and they're calling it a loan. But, you know, $600 billion, that's a big chunk of money.
A good amount, yeah.
This is basically counted as an asset in rough terms on their balance sheet.
Exactly.
It's kind of interesting because many of these, including your home, is probably located somewhere in a mortgage-backed security, right? And
oh yes, absolutely.
So is it, you know, you think of these securities, and with all these houses sitting, when I would think the best interest of the investor would have them be turned at any price just to bring some kind of income back into the security.
But, well, actually, about the mortgage-backed security, I just found out something very interesting just before I left work today, is that these broker-dealers, or what they're doing with some of these lower-value mortgage-backed securities, is they're taking one price and then applying it to 10 other securities. if these securities are what they call, has similar characteristics, because what we did is we pulled prices from IDC for these, for like 10 securities, these mortgage-backed securities, and then we go into our pricing service and say, okay, now apply these to the portfolio because we don't want to use the broker-dealer price. And they say, well, we can't do it because they're using only one price from a broker-dealer to price all of those securities. So we're not even getting real prices from those nine other securities. We're getting an estimate of one security to apply to the other. So they're not even pulling the prices.
Yeah, you can't even call an accountant a bean counter anymore because they don't even use the beans.
That's right. They're not even using the beans.
All right, we're going to pick this up after the break because I got a couple questions I want to ask you, Bill. I mean, the shadow inventory is such a shadow that it makes me wonder whether it's actually even there, and we'll have to explore that. Plus, we're also going to take a look at what's been going on at the Democratic National Convention and a couple of interesting articles regarding the LIBOR manipulation scandal, so you want to stay tuned for that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Walt Thiessen, Gene DiNardo, and Bill G here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And just a reminder, you can always check out the archives both here on PRN.FM and on our own website, www.freedomnewshour.com. Find out about the past shows we've done, listen to previous broadcasts, and find out what's coming up on future broadcasts. Now, before the break, Bill, you were talking about how they have this valuation system where they apply the same price to a variety of different properties. And the question that comes to my mind is, why do they bother? I mean, if they're already overvaluing based on what the value of the mortgages that they're holding, why even mess around with this other model?
Which model are you talking about? Are you talking about the...
Well, maybe I misunderstood, but I was under the impression that you were talking about how they don't use firm prices of the property based on what the market value is. They make their pricing based on what other similar properties are valued at. And yet,
I'm talking about the mortgage-backed securities.
Oh, you're talking about the securities. Oh, my mistake. Okay, now I understand. Okay, well, if that's the case, then the question becomes: isn't this more than just a shadow inventory? Isn't this a shadow inventory that also has, I guess you'd call it, an echo factor many thousands of times because of the credit default swaps?
Yes, absolutely. Because the credit default swaps are designed to kick in when these mortgages are not being paid. And obviously, I'm not paying my mortgage.
Right. Which is a nice way to save on rent, but
well, it is a nice way to save on rent.
But
well, I mean, technically, you know, I handed the deed over to the bank, you know, so technically I'm off the hook.
So if someone had a credit default swap on that property, is it being paid right now? Is it?
Yes, that it would have kicked in. Yes.
Now, and it kicks in at the original value, right?
Not necessarily.
Well, not necessarily.
It depends on
the contract.
Yeah, it's a contract.
Yeah, okay.
It's like an insurance contract. It's based on how much premium you put in and who's backing it. I mean, that's what nearly destroyed AIG.
Yeah,
right. So I'm going to put you on the spot here, Bill. And I know it's an unfair question because there's no answer to it that any of us can come up with. But okay. $600 billion. That's how much the Citigroup is showing on their books for this shadow inventory, which has no identifiable or discernible name to it. And apparently this shadow inventory is backed by a bunch of CDSs that themselves have very nebulous terms about because they're always different, so nobody really knows what they amount to. So best guess, these assets, when everything shakes out, what are they actually worth?
Well, I know that the balance on my mortgage was $170,000. The best offer we got on a short sale was $132,000, which they rejected.
That's
25-26% less. So at this point, the house has been left abandoned for 3 years, and it hasn't been maintained. So the best that they're going to be able to get for that particular property is $90,000. So
basically, refusing a short sale was a really boneheaded move.
Oh, absolutely boneheaded move. The whole thing would have been fixed if they just accepted the short sale.
And I think we get down to the meat of it here. Why do you think they rejected the idea of the short sale at 132?
Just to keep that inflated value?
They rejected the idea of the short sale because at the time they believed that the market was already starting to recover and they thought they can get a better price selling it on their own in foreclosure sale.
You think they really believed that?
Or they wanted to repossess the property for this very purpose, to hold on to it in their shadow inventory, so that way when a recovery did eventually come down the pike, they'd be able to sell it for market.
Yeah,
I
think that's an amazing example of how banks do not exist in any kind of competitive environment. I mean, who can afford to do that in any other business where you just hold hundreds of thousands of properties for the future, just for the heck of it, because it looks better on your balance sheet? I mean, where's the competition there? Where's the force saying, you know, you need to get this sold and get this money into something that actually produces something? I mean, it's just goofy.
And an auction, if they actually put this house up on foreclosure auction, the best they can probably get for it is maybe $70,000. So that's $100,000 less than what their book value is or what they say their market value is right now. So that's, you know, what is that, 50% markdown?
Times all the other houses they have in the same situation.
Exactly. So that $600 billion, what is that actually worth? Maybe half that.
And Gene's point is well taken. I mean, where's the competition? But the thought that comes to my mind is even more poignant, I think, because we've been told over and over and over and over again how important it is to regulate not only the housing industry, but the banking industry and all the investment industry, yada, yada, yada. And they've been writing up all these regulations over the years and blah, 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 blah. I mean, just on and on and on. Where's the regulation?
What has it gotten us? Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, the only regulation in this particular case that applies is FAS 57.
Yeah.
Well, which is the one that I'm most familiar with. And because Citigroup is such an enormous, too-big-to-fail bank, they can basically write their own rules and write their own valuation techniques and get away with it. When I was reading their disclosure, I was like, we could never get away with that. You know, I have a $14 billion company that I work for, and there's no way we could get away with what they're getting away with in that disclosure.
And I have to admit, there is something up my sleeve, the reason I'm bringing this up, but we've been told from 2010 on that Dodd-Frank, that bill, basically was going to prevent this kind of thing from continuing to happen in the future. That was a lie. It was all, yeah. as we said here on the show, it was a lie, and this is how the lie is playing out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Dodd-Frank is a joke.
Yes, and I think it's important to recognize that, but not just because it's an election year, and I don't mean to even say that as a point that we should favor the Republicans over the Democrats because they've been just as bad, but quite honestly, the centerpiece of the Obama administration's handling of the financial crisis of 2008 has been bust. It's been a 100% bust.
Yeah.
Well, it has been to get the money back to the big-time investors, the big banks like we've just mentioned.
Well, did that real well.
Yeah, so, you know, basically it's trickle-down theory.
No, it's trickle-up. Well, everything trickles up to the bank.
Depending on what side you look at. The side that actually happened or the side that they say is going to happen someday.
Yeah, right. Well, the next time that Congress comes along with a new regulatory package, I want people to remember what's going on here and realize that this is par for the course. This isn't an aberrant step in the journey of regulation. This is the way regulation normally works out. It's just that in this particular case, it's very visible to all of us because the economy is so drastically hit by it this time around. But this is par for the course. There's nothing unusual here.
Oh, the big boys, they not only love regulation, they're the ones that actually craft it.
Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's where the big money is, right?
Where the money is.
Well, speaking of money and speaking of the manipulation of it, the LIBOR manipulation scandal continues to lumber along, although the major media have been kind of running out of things to investigate on because the government authorities haven't released any new information in the last couple months. And, you know, after a while, even the talking heads forget, you know, can't think of anything else to talk about on the subject. But nevertheless, there are some who do try to say something, and a couple of opinion pieces came out on Bloomberg and on, Reuters, I think it was? Politico, I'm sorry. The Politico one really caught my attention. I just want to read it to you before I tell you who wrote it. I won't read the whole thing, but let me just read a few paragraphs from it. This is entitled, "Renew Urgency on Wall Street Probe." It says the Obama administration's investigation of major international banks for manipulation of the London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR, has been in the headlines lately, and that's good news. The bank's actions have cost savers and investors dearly, shaken anew confidence in our financial markets, and revealed once again pervasive corruption within our banking system. On this critical issue, the administration has shown teeth, and the international community is hopefully moving swiftly to ensure accountability. But the administration's action on this scandal raises a key question. When will we see results from the investigation of Wall Street for the mortgage securities fraud that led to the devastating collapse of the housing, jobs, and financial markets? The president announced the investigation in this year's State of the Union address, saying a new working group would be staffed by, quote, highly trained investigators to crack down on large-scale fraud, unquote. New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, the co-chairman of that working group and a strong proponent of aggressive action, predicted results within 6 months. But the jury is still out whether the investigation will bring Wall Street CEO to justice and deter future wrongdoing. Attorney General Eric Holder acknowledged earlier this year why a thorough inquiry is so crucial. He said the roots of our recent economic collapse can in many ways be traced to instances of unethical and reckless misconduct that took place in major financial centers like Wall Street. These abuses have driven away many who were once willing to invest in our economy and destroyed once thriving communities. And some of the practices that have been uncovered have placed unprecedented and unfair challenges before cash-strapped governments, local police departments, small businesses, and American workers and consumers. Now, this particular article does go on for six, eight, ten more paragraphs, and I won't go into all of it. But I just want to play a little quick game with you to see if you can guess who it was who wrote this op-ed piece. Any clues that you see in there, Bill or Gene, from what was written there as who this could possibly be?
Got me on that.
Who's the guy who wrote The Big Short?
Who was that?
Oh, I forget his name.
I can't remember. Well, it doesn't matter. I'm wrong anyway.
Okay.
Let me tell you the answer. The answer is that the author of this piece was Phil Angelides. Now, it's the former state treasurer of California and the chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
You're kidding.
Now, for those of you who may not remember what the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is, they're the body that was convened by the federal government to investigate the causes of the financial crisis of 2008, and they're the ones who concluded that the whole thing was a scheme among people who were unethically investing mortgages on credit default swaps, and that it had nothing to do with the monetary and banking system at all. It had nothing to do with the impact of the Fed on the money supply. It was only just these unethical investors. So here's the guy who basically whitewashed the financial crisis of 2008, giving his strong prescription on what should be done about the Wall Street manipulators in the LIBOR scandal. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking to myself, people are actually paying attention to what this guy's saying. I mean,
unbelievable.
That's really quite shocking when you think about that. So that one really caught my attention. I just had to share that with everybody. I mean, basically a guy who is the king of whitewash is laying out his golden strategy for how to bring the bankers to bay. And in fact, he has a long history of letting people go.
Well, he's an expert.
He's an expert.
One of those experts that they quote and they never say who it is, you know.
Well, in this case they did.
Yeah, in this case they gave up the info.
The other piece that I dug up came from Bloomberg, and actually this appears on businessweek.com, but they pick up a lot of Bloomberg stuff. And this particular article, well, I'll just read from it, says, Bloomberg View, Getting to the Bottom of LIBOR. It says the global investigation into the manipulation of London Interbank Offered Rate has so far done a good job, really, of exposing how bankers corrupted one of the world's most important financial indicators. Now authorities need to take a giant step further, make banks release the data needed to determine how much damage was done and who should bear the most responsibility. Now, before I even go any further on this one, I have to ask a question. Do either of you guys think that the investigators so far have done a good job of revealing what's been going on with the LIBOR scandal?
A good job of not revealing.
They're doing a great job of keeping it as opaque as possible.
Concealing is the word, yeah.
So that's the first question I have to ask of Bloomberg. What have you been smoking?
Well, I think they probably do smoke over there. That is Bloomberg. It seems on Bloomberg you can read something and go, that's a pretty good article. Then you read the next article and go, what is wrong with that guy?
Yeah. Well, reading further down in the article, it says, it's up to the authorities investigating LIBOR to break the information blockade. In the U.S., for example, the Office of Financial Research set up by the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act has the subpoena power needed to get the data and the brain power required to crunch the numbers. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't we just 5 minutes ago point out that Dodd-Frank has been a complete bust?
Complete bust, yes.
So basically, Bloomberg is looking at something that has been totally incompetent when it comes to putting some kind of a hold on the banking system and saying, hey, we need more of that.
And also you have to keep in mind that Dodd-Frank has also been largely discredited and disavowed in the entire market. Nobody takes it seriously.
Well, it has even been used or enforced.
Yeah, yeah. It's a joke among it's the butt of jokes on Wall Street.
Well, I think it was the perfect time to come up with something like that, and then everybody thinks you're the big hero, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they do. They react to the public opinion, and instead of actually getting busy and saying, well, how can we, you know, make this better? You know, what can we put out there that's complicated and everything and seems, you know, just like it's really something, and then people will vote for us in the next election.
And the whole purpose of Dodd-Frank was not only to do the regulation, but also to regulate the derivative market. Because I listened to a talk by Sheila Blair, and she was talking about how she's the former chairman of the FDIC, how the Dodd-Frank was supposed to help provide a little bit of transparency to the derivative market, and it got completely taken out of the bill at the last minute.
It sounds like the lobbying interests are doing a very good job.
They're doing a great job.
As they usually do.
Well, I mean, when I read these two pieces, it occurred to me that what we're actually seeing here is the vanguard of the, how do I describe it, of the power elite apologists setting themselves up as the experts who will take all the horrible people to task who did wrong,
right,
so that when they can finally make their proposals about what will actually be done about it, well, they're the ones who were shouting the loudest in the beginning. So, of course, they have the best solutions, right?
Right.
Well, you know, the thing that people fail to realize is most of this stuff is completely legal, and that's the real problem. It's, you know, this stuff is all backed by the government, and, you know, if something happens, like, you know, the economic problems we're having and, you know, the crash, then they say, well, let's fix this. Well, this stuff is legal to start with. What are you fixing?
any attempt to make it illegal is blocked by the lobbyists.
Anything that actually would make change, right, in a positive direction.
I think what we have effectively laid out here is, first of all, how completely unable regulation is to address this kind of situation. Because regulation, this is a point I've made in the past, regulation is really not about putting reins on you know, corporate power to run amok or whatever. It's actually about giving them license to run amok. People don't actually see it that way, but literally that's what regulation is. If you weren't going to regulate, you were actually going to ban something. And that's the one thing that the corporate power don't want to happen. They don't want to ban the activities. So regulation is a wonderful way to avoid being banned. And of course, because the largest powers are the most responsible, which is one of the craziest pieces of logic in history, therefore regulation can be used to give license to these largest powers to do what they've been doing all along, because after all, they're the most reliable ones, right?
It actually provides a rule book to cheat. It allows you to engage in unethical behavior and know where the line is to where you're crossing the line into illegality.
And those people
who actually go to jail are the people who've crossed the line because they were too stupid to realize that they've crossed the line.
Yeah, and it also placates the population. The population says, well, look, we have a problem, but something's being done. Whereas,
exactly,
like you say, it's only being metered and allowing these huge companies to profit on, you know, what should be actually illegal. You know, some examples.
And what strikes me about all these high-powered players who are able to play this manipulate the regulation game, they actually put Al Capone to shame. They make Al Capone look like a thumb-fingered idiot who doesn't know the first thing about how to be successful in organized crime, because these guys have it down. They have it down pat. And not only do they have it down pat, they've managed, as you were pointing out, Bill, to make their organized crime legal, so it's no longer crime.
That's pretty
cool.
Yeah.
if you're into that kind of thing, you know?
Yep.
All you need to do is throw some campaign money a politician's way, and then all of a sudden you're legal.
Well, speaking of campaign money, Gene actually was digging a little bit into the campaign as being presented by the Democratic National Convention and the speech that Bill Clinton made. And Gene, what did you find when you did your investigating?
Well, I actually watched his speech, and it was a good speech. I mean, he's a good talker, and he's interesting. And the best quote he had is he was quoting, this is Bill Clinton, was quoting the Romney campaign pollster Neil Newhouse. And the quote was, "We are not going to let our campaign be dictated by fact checkers. I thought that was great. We're not going to let no facts get in the way here. But anyway, these guys, they took apart Bill's speech, so I'll go through some of the major points. Bill said that Obama has offered a reasonable plan of $4 trillion in debt reduction, and that's the figure they keep coming up with. For every $2.5 trillion in spending cuts, he raises a dollar in new revenues. And he has tight controls on future spending. That's the kind of balanced approach proposed by the Simpson-Boyles Commission. So the fact checkers go on to say, by the administration's own math, you have nearly $3.8 trillion in spending cuts compared to $1.5 trillion in tax increases. So presto, you get the $1 tax increase for $2.50 spending cuts. But virtually no serious budget analyst agreed with this accounting. The $4 trillion figure, for instance, includes counting some $1 trillion in cuts reached a year ago in budget negotiations with Congress. Moreover, the administration is also counting $848 billion in phantom savings from winding down the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So again, they're counting money that that they aren't going to spend. Rather than an actual reduction. Rather than good arithmetic, independent budget analysis called the maneuver a major budget gimmick. The administration also counts $800 billion in saving in debt payments from lower deficits as a spending cut, which is a dubious claim. Clinton went on to say, as we could have done better, but last year the Republicans blocked the president's job plan, costing the economy more than 1 million new jobs. So here's another job score, President Obama, plus 4.5 million congressional Republicans, zero. And the fact checkers say that Obama's job plan was more of a rhetorical device aimed at Republicans rather than a real plan. He even used the same $1 trillion in previously agreed savings with Republicans, was supposed to be in the budget in order to pay for the plan. The jobs plan also would be paid for with the imaginary money from winding down the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Get the picture. Clinton praises Obama both for his sound budget math and his jobs plan, even though the money to fund the budget and the jobs plan is used twice. This was a quote that I remember. He said, during this period, more than 500,000 manufacturing jobs have been created under President Obama. That's the first time manufacturing jobs have increased since the 90s. Which I believe is when Clinton was in office. Clinton is referring to the period since February 2010, the administration's preferred date for counting employment figures. If you count from the beginning of Obama's term, the Bureau of Labor Statistics show that manufacturing jobs have declined by more than 500,000. Manufacturing jobs have been on a long, steep decline since the middle of Clinton's term, with some 2 million jobs lost during the recession. So it's a downward trend that's been continued for a long time. Here's one. I'll go through one more here. Clinton went on to say that more than 3 million young people between 19 and 25 are insured for the first time because their parents' policies can cover them. The fact checkers say that, interestingly, Clinton frames this more accurately than President Obama. The Department of Health and Human Services in June reported that more than 3 million young adults would not have health insurance with the health care law. Obama prefers to cite a private survey published by the Commonwealth Fund that showed that 6.6 million young adults stayed on or joined their parents' health plans in 2011. Not all of those people were uninsured. Some simply joined their parents' plans. So it's the typical twisting of facts that all politicians use, and Clinton's no exception.
He's good at that.
Yeah, he was good at that.
And actually, we're just a couple minutes late. We have a special, well, I can't call him a guest, but a good friend joining us. Jake Tao was able to call in at the last minute. And Jake, I'm not sure how much you caught of the broadcast. I was going to have you comment on Gene's report, but maybe you might kick in on what was going on with the LIBOR report. Do you want to give us a few words of wisdom in our last couple minutes here?
Yeah, I don't know if there'll be words of wisdom, but what's pretty interesting is, at least at the Democratic National Convention, they invited President Clinton to speak. What's also kind of interesting, I think it's been covered elsewhere, but at the Republican National Convention, not only did Mitt Romney and his gang not invite the last sitting president, George W. Bush, and former Vice President Dick Cheney, you know, beloved by us on the show, but he also didn't bother inviting the last vice presidential nominee, Sarah Palin, nor did he allow most of the other presidential candidates to speak, including one who I believe... Ron Paul, who was, I'm not quite sure if he ever was officially nominated by a state, but at one point he had enough states in order to be nominated until the gang changed the number, changed the way that they picked, actually changed all the delegates from Maine, which dropped him out of any chance of being nominated. So it's interesting to see that at least the Democratic Party pretends like they're proud of the previous presidents that were on before, while the Republican Party has kind of given up on anybody else associated with it, except for Mitt Romney, which is an interesting strategy to take.
Actually, maybe we can't blame them for that, and I guess we'll have to leave it right there because, unfortunately, we're out of time as usual. But, wow, this time we got four guys to sign off with. We haven't been able to do that before. But, Bill, Gene, Jake, it's been a pleasure as usual.
See y'all next week.
All right, we'll see you next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.